From the heart of the NYU Langone Medical Center, this is About Our Kids.
Good morning, this is Jess Shatkin. You're listening to About Our Kids on Doctor Radio, Sirius XM 110. It is a balmy Friday out there. It's I don't know much about Florida, but it feels like Florida, Melanie. So you can follow us on Twitter at NYU Docs to find out the topics we're discussing on each show, and you can interact with us live by tweeting your questions and comments. You can also follow the topics, expert links, and comments on our Sirius XM Doctor Radio Facebook page. You can reach us for the next 2 hours at 877-NYU-DOCS. That's 877-698-3627, or by email at docs@siriusxm.com. So in our first hour today, we'll be speaking about trauma in the wake of a number of tragedies this past week. Most particularly on our mind is the Pittsburgh shooting, so many people lost there, and other recent events as well. And then in the second hour, it'll be open phone lines, and you can call in and ask any questions related to parenting, diagnoses, medication, psychotherapies, referrals, what have you. 877-698-3627 for the next 2 hours. So our first segment is how to talk to your kids about trauma. And again, the one that's featured in the news this week is a Pittsburgh Tree of Life Synagogue massacre. In studio, we have Betsy Scher Levy, who is a clinical psychologist in private practice working with children, adolescents, and adults. She's adjunct faculty in clinical psychology, doctoral program at Teachers College at Columbia. She's been the consulting psychologist for the 92nd Street Y, which plays a big role in our community here in New York, at the nursery school for 25 years. And you work with children primarily just 2.5 to 5, yes?
Yes, I see children 2.5 to 5 at the nursery school and children of older ages in my private practice as well.
Got it.
Including teens and young adults who are very often functioning as teens
sure.
these days. So I've had a wide range of experience with children, adolescents, and young adults.
Great. Thank you, Betsy. And also Glenn Sachs, a professor in the Department of Child, Adolescent Psychiatry here at NYU, in now what we call, Glenn, the Child Study Center at the Hassenfeld Children's Hospital at NYU Langone and NYU School of Medicine. So that's a mouthful.
Yep.
And he's a physician scientist with a focus on psychiatric consequences of traumatic events. He's author of the textbook Trauma Systems Therapy for Children and Teens, now in its second edition. And he created something called Trauma Systems Therapy, or TST, something he uses to teach other mental health care providers how to diagnose and treat kids with trauma. We can get into that if we have the time. So thanks for being here as well.
Of course.
So mass shootings in the news. You know, we don't have to go back very far to find a lot of recent events. Sandy Hook, Columbine, Parkland, Florida, Las Vegas, the Texas shooting massacre, the Charleston, South Carolina. So these events happen with what feels like increasing frequency. Interestingly, when you look at children's safety, at least it's my read in looking at the statistics on this, that kids are probably by and large safer than they've ever been, in that there aren't many kidnappings anymore. You don't
Very
hear about
true.
A lot of, you know, molestation of kids in terms of the numbers that we used to have more in the 60s and 70s. Yet we're more aware, and we hear a lot more about these mass shootings. And the event in Pittsburgh is really foremost in our mind. I lived in Pittsburgh from 2003 to 2005, just a few blocks from where this synagogue was. And once this happened, I reached out to a lot of friends in Pittsburgh. I didn't, thankfully, I suppose, know the names of the people. That wasn't my generation, but everybody I know in Pittsburgh knows these people. These were members of the community. So it's in the news a lot. How do we present this issue to our kids? Do we bring it up? Do we wait for them to bring it up? How do we handle it? Betsy, let me start with you. What do you think?
Sure. I think the primary issue here is the age of our children, the developmental level of our children, and what they can and cannot process. And by process, I mean what they can take in a way that we hope they can understand and use in a mental health context that will not be excessively frightening and really paralyze their ability to go about their everyday lives with a sense of safety. First and foremost, I like to emphasize that before we talk to our children about these tragic events, we need to talk to ourselves and make sure that we have made some sense of peace, the best that we can, with what has occurred and why, and understanding it and taking a moment for ourselves to, you know, much like on an airplane, when you put the oxygen on yourself before you do your child, it's a similar
sure.
situation.
Take your own temperature first.
Take your temperature. Take mm-hmm. a walk. Take 5 minutes. Because depending on the age of your child, they could be on you, on top of you with questions very, very quickly before you've even processed this information.
So when you say, you know, take a moment for yourself, yes. what are you really saying people should do? Is this to actually just take a reckoning of what does this mean to me, or how do I want to talk to my kids about it, or both?
I mean both. Mm-hmm. I mean, what does this mean to me? What is this bringing up for me? What calls may I want to make to make sure loved ones or their friends and family are safe? How do I make peace with this in my own personal context? Mm-hmm. And then think about who your children are, what their ages are. Should you speak with them together or not together? Because you may absolutely not want to be speaking with a 3-year-old when you're speaking with a 13-year-old or a 16-year-old.
So let me stop you there for a second and ask you more about that, because parents are not, when the kids are born, by and large, developmental experts.
Absolutely.
They become child development experts as their kids get older.
And they have to.
They have to. And they're great at talking about what a 5-year-old can do when their kids are 7. But when their kids are 4, they're not always sure what a 5-year-old can do.
That's
or what a 5-year-old
right.
can be thinking about, unless they've had kids before, they've worked in nursery schools, they've been a therapist, they've been a teacher, whatever. So how is a parent to know what their kid is ready to hear?
Now, that's a great question. First of all, you can take your cues from your child. My motto has been listen to what they're asking, answer it to the best you can, honestly, what they are asking you. And for a young child, do not say more. There is no reason to give more data to a young child's mind when you're not sure how they're processing it, to address your point, than is asked for. And I also think that with increased information for a very young child, you'll do nothing but confuse them and increase anxiety and the mm-hmm. sense of trauma. So, for example, it's been very interesting for me to see this week, after the Tree of Life tragedy, that in the nursery school where I work, there have been very few, if any, children or parents who have brought the topic to the nursery school teachers directly or to the administration. There was an email that went out about how to speak to children and what not to say, and then there was a sense of quiet.
Would you have expected something different?
I would not have in this context, but I have had experience with young families and young children, for example, in 9/11 kind of tragedy, where even the very young children were exposed to a degree that we would have liked to have prevented.
Sure, well, certainly in New York, where everything changed in New York.
So there I did see a difference.
Yeah.
This time, there was a sense of calm in the younger population, and the teachers were trying to continue a sense of calm and everyday behavior. But I believe this is very much because we reached out to the parent body before school began.
Yeah.
And, you know, the sense of what a child can process is very, very up in the air. And, of course, we have to remember the classroom community and how easy it is for fears to become contagious.
Sure.
And all caregivers and parents to be answering things for these very young children
right.
in different ways.
Sure, sure, sure.
So we don't have really control there,
yeah.
much like we do at home around the kitchen table. Even with our older children, we have a greater sense of control and what we want to transmit and how we want to transmit that to each child and their developmental needs and the way they process fear, anxiety, and trauma.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Glenn, I want to bring you in 1 second. Let me just invite parents to give us a call. If your kids have been asking you questions about the Pittsburgh massacre or other recent traumatic events or past traumatic events, if you have questions about how to talk to your kids, we have two experts in the house, Betsy Shirlevy and Glenn Sachs. Our number is 877-698-3627. You're listening to About Our Kids on Dr. Radio, Sirius XM 110. I'm Jess Shatkin. So is everything Betsy's saying making sense to you, Glenn?
Yes, in a big way.
In a big way.
And in fact, you know, I've sketched some notes I have, and it's she just covered
your notes. You can toss those notes
Sorry
away.
Sorry about that.
But just to echo echo a couple of things that I think are really important is, you know, let's take a second to think of the magnitude of a sort of event like that. And as parents, I'm a parent, kids, I'm a Jewish person, I've been to many temples, and it's hard to imagine anything more horrible than that, the worst nightmare. And so just to echo the idea of kind of taking your own pulse before you get started and trying to help your child, because as parents, our job is to keep our kids safe, and this is a setting where we expect safety, obviously, and it shakes our world as parents. So I think it's really important. But then as we take our own pulse and we check in with ourselves, we also should check in with the facts, Jeff, that you mentioned at the beginning about the statistics of how likely this is to happen, even though when we have an event like this, we think it can happen tomorrow because it shakes our sense of safety, or the fact that children are probably safer now than they've been in history. Yeah. And so I think those are really important things. And then I just want to echo something really, really important is that there's no one right answer. Mm-hmm. And it's so important to be attuned with our kids, to know, to ask way more than say things, to find out what they know, what they think, what they feel, and to start from there.
Yeah, and to answer in part then the question I posed you, Betsy, about how do you know if you're not a child development expert what your kid's ready for? You ask them questions, right? You say, hey, what do you know? What are you thinking about? What's going on? Did you hear about this thing? Or they said this, they sent a flyer home from school, whatever it is.
And you may not be an expert in child development, but you know your kids. Mm-hmm. You know your kids. You've been with them. You know them. You know what makes them vulnerable and all of that. Of course, there's things you don't know about development, but you know a lot.
Yeah. And do you see parents making mistakes in this often, or do you feel like parents, they sort of find their way by and large?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's two sorts of mistakes to make. One is to behave in such an alarmed way.
Absolutely.
Because you're not grounded in the likelihood of this happening, and that can create a lot of distress. And
so you're not going to school tomorrow. We're staying home tomorrow.
Yeah, we want to create settings where kids are strong and resilient and that sort of thing, and that is against that. The other thing that's really important is, you know, not to deviate from reality, not to, in our need to want to help our kids feel good and calm, there's an impulse, obviously, to say this could never happen, you never have to worry about it, the world is completely safe, and I don't think that's good either.
You don't?
No. Yeah. Because the reality is, although the probability is very low, there are bad things that happen. Mm-hmm. There are bad people that want to hurt good people, and that's simply true.
So what if your kid's a bit on the anxious side, and your kid's likely to take something like that very small possibility, improbability of something bad happening, and run with it and chew on it?
Well, one of the things I think is the issue of trust. There's nothing that's going to make an anxious kid or any kid more anxious than to feel that they can't trust their parent for bringing reality in. Mm-hmm. And a kid, you know, every kid's different, but could pick up when your parent isn't speaking the truth. So I think that's very important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so parents should be honest and yet not entirely forthcoming necessarily with every detail, but they should inquire what their kids know, they should give back some information, and we should still acknowledge that schools, churches, synagogues are still really the safest places for people to be. A better place for a kid to be than sitting at home alone watching TV and not going to school in terms of their development and what's good for them.
I think that's true, but also not to shirk the can this ever happen?
Can this ever happen to me, Dad? And you say...
You say, you know, this did happen. It's very, very unlikely that this would ever happen. You should know the adults are doing everything to make sure that you're not exposed, that will be safe. There, you see the security around. The adults care about this, know about this, and we're here. But the world can be dangerous, and as a family, we're together, and we need to be strong about these.
And part of my job is to teach you how to navigate this world.
Exactly.
Yeah, because as you're saying, this is going to help us establish some resilience in the kids. Yeah. They're going to think, okay, there are some pitfalls out there. I got to be careful about them. And if I follow the rules and if I learn from my parents, I'll probably be able to negotiate what I need to in order to stay safe.
Exactly.
All right. You're listening to About Our Kids, Dr. Radio, Sirius XM 110. Let's go to a caller, Summer in Washington, D.C. Welcome to About Our Kids.
Yes, hi. I have a question about my three-year-old. A couple nights ago, I'm pregnant, 26 weeks pregnant.
Congratulations.
And thank you. And I was walking in the mall, and I started having contractions, really bad contractions. And it just got really worse, and we ended up calling 911. And I could tell she was anxious and nervous, and when 911 got there, it was just so hectic. I was shaking. Apparently, I had an infection. So they took me away, and she started screaming and yelling. And then she told my mom was there, and she told my mom afterward that she's really scared, and she wants to be with me. And then they wouldn't let me see her in the hospital, and the next day when I tried to, I mean, they discharged me, they gave me antibiotics, they discharged me. The next day when I got home and I tried to talk to her about it, she just smiled that I was there, but she wouldn't let me, like, she would change subject. She didn't want to talk about it. So I guess me and my husband, we were worried, like, does that cause trauma to a three-year-old when she's never seen an ambulance taking, you know?
Yeah, great question.
Sure. She loves.
Yeah, yeah.
And what can we do? How can we talk to her? Is there anything as parents we can do?
Yeah, great. Betsy, this seems to be right in your wheelhouse, doesn't
it? Yes, absolutely. Yeah. First of all, it's not to worry, that she didn't want to discuss this in any greater depth the next day. Because some children, when they see that you are okay, in fact, go inward and process the trauma to which they've been exposed without articulating it. And that feels actually more safe to them. It's a way for them to separate themselves from the trauma. But you have a wonderful opportunity here to give an example of how we have so many helping individuals in our society. We have people who work for ambulances, firefighters, policemen, doctors, teachers, all who are here to keep us safe. And it is very important to let them do their jobs and listen to what they say, because they are here to keep us safe. As you see, they helped Mommy very much, and Mommy is now home and feeling better. Now, if this child wants to process internally and quietly for a while, that's absolutely fine. You might find that she plays out some of this trauma in her imaginative play, and that would be extremely helpful for her. And when she's ready and gives you the signs that she's ready to talk a bit about, Mommy, what was happening? Was the baby okay? Were you okay? I was scared. Then is the time for you to be as supportive as possible and normalize the situation. Sometimes these things do happen when Mommy are having babies, and that's why it's so important that we listen to the doctors and we listen to the policemen and people who are here to help us. That translates beautifully into what we try to tell children after these larger traumas, which is, listen to your teachers, listen to the police, even to the government, listen to the rules that your school is telling you when things like this happening. People are here to help you. They don't mean to separate you from Mommy and make you sad, but in fact, they need to take the best care of Mommy so she could be home and well with you the next day, ready to play.
So Betsy, mom comes home and says, listen, I'm fine. Everything's okay.
Yes.
I missed you so much. And I want to tell you, you know, what happened. And the daughter says, she changes the subject. She's 3 years old. She picks up her toys. She walks in the other room. She plays with the dog. She doesn't seem interested.
Right.
And you're saying, mom, don't push it at that point. Just let her sort of have some space.
Absolutely.
Come back around to it now and again.
We need space as adults. Mm-hmm. Our children need more space.
Yeah.
They need time to sort of collect what they're feeling and what their fears are and what they're thinking, play them out. Now, if the child begins to ask what happened, then you want to be very concrete, very simple, very clear. Don't give any extra information that might be frightening, even if you don't think it sounds frightening.
Right.
It may in the mind of a child. And here is where I get to that point of know your child.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's so important that's been said earlier this morning about knowing your child's level of anxiety, how much imaginative thinking do they have, where will they take this, do they always catastrophize, do they tend not to catastrophize, but keep it simple.
Yeah.
Keep it clear.
Yeah, I agree with everything as usual. I'd say
as usual. He always agrees with everything.
Okay, good. This is really wonderful. I too agree with everything.
I'd add one thing to it. I mean, the one risk in these contexts is a child being left to feel alone. Like they have big time feelings they can't articulate, and they don't feel it's okay to articulate. And in that, it's important to be really attuned to, if you know your child has been really panicked about it, even to normalize it very briefly. Honey, I understand that you felt really anxious, and I'm back. I'm safe. We're all safe. And, you know, anytime you want to talk about it. And then to just be you know, this mother, the caller is obviously very attuned to her kid, and just to really just check in maybe in an extra careful way.
Yeah.
Yes.
So again, and it's not imposing all the story. It's not talking about the tubes and the blood. It's not talking about how scared
Absolutely.
I was. It's not talking about the siren was so loud. And, you know, it's just a very calm, like, these things happen. Mommy got a little sick for a little bit.
Absolutely.
It's so great that when you get sick, there's people here to help you and you come back better.
And I would emphasize how well the child behaved despite their fear.
Mm-hmm.
It was very understandable that you were afraid. Mommy wasn't with you any longer. You were with your grandmother. But you were really helping me to get the help that I needed. You did a terrific job this morning, and I know you were frightened.
Great, great. Summer, I hope that's helpful.
Yes, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for your call. You're listening to About Our Kids, Dr. Radio, Sirius XM 110. Our guests are Betsy Sherlevy and Glenn Sachs. We're talking about trauma. 877-698-3627 is our number, or by email at docs@siriusxm.com. Let's get on to another caller, Maria in Florida. Welcome to About Our Kids.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly. What's on your mind, Maria?
I have a 13-year-old daughter who lost her father. She was two at the time. He had bipolar disorder, and he ended up taking his own life. Since then, I mean, she understands. Obviously, I told her that her father passed away, who was very sick, but I never told her the circumstances of his death. And, you know, at the time, she was too little, and I didn't want her to be talking about it inappropriately, I guess. I felt she was too young to handle that. And now that she's gotten older, I feel like I need to let her know at some point how he died. But then again, you know, I'm worried. She's a teenager now. I mean, she's doing great, but I feel for her carrying the weight of the circumstances of what happened. So I'm not sure exactly when or how I should go about telling her, or is it even necessary to give her that kind of information
at
this point?
Great questions, Maria. First of all, we're all so terribly sorry about the tragedy that's befallen your family.
Absolutely.
And then to have a child who's so young that at two, of course, how much detail can you give? And even at two, although your child would have noticed, of course, the absence of her father, she wouldn't have had a lot of conscious questions or questions that she would have verbalized other than where's daddy maybe or daddy gone or whatever a two-year-old might say. And then time goes by, you get accustomed to the new normal, which is not having him around. And then when do you bring this up? How do you address this? And then how do you, if at all, address the graphic detail of what happened, if not graphic? You know, the fact that the man had a major mental illness that overcame him, that he became so terribly depressed that he took his own life, which is a remarkable circumstance. And of course, any kid is going to then say to themselves, and to you maybe, could this happen to me?
Exactly,
is this in my gene? Am I destined for this? So it really is a fundamentally scary thing. And on the other hand, you also want to make sure that the child at some point as they age towards adulthood is aware of this genetic family history. It may very well be that mood disorders run in the family. They commonly do. It doesn't mean what happened to him is going to happen to her. But, it, you know, with a father who's bipolar and a father who killed himself, there, if it's a biological father, there's quite a good chance that, not 90%, but there's a higher than average chance that she may suffer some mood difficulties, not necessarily bipolar disorder. It may be disruptive behavior in ADHD. It may be depression.
She does have ADHD.
Yeah, not uncommon in the children of bipolar parents, and as well as would be general mood disorders and anxiety. So things to be aware of and things to understand. So first of all, again, thanks for calling. Really interesting question. Glenn, you wanna start?
Yes.
And I'm just gonna ask you to move a little closer to your mic, because then we get a really, I know it's like you gotta kiss this thing. I know. It's just, it's just that then
it's
we hear you so perfectly.
Experience.
It's an intimate experience.
Exactly.
So I guess one thing is you don't wanna leave this child feeling like there are things that are undiscussable, that our family secrets, all of that.
Right.
And you know, there's no one occasion to tell, but for the caller, I mean, she's with her 13-year-old a lot of the time, and I'd be just very curious, does the child bring this up? Does she ever talk about her father? Does your caller know about questions that her daughter may have? What I would be doing is just listening really closely, and if the child never brings up, you know, father, what happened, I might gently bring it up. You know, do you ever think of, you know, dad? Just to really know what she's thinking, and then to naturally weave the discussion in over, you know, over the next few years, it would be good. But to be revealing something about the history. But I think you need to do it kind of naturally and not kind of impose on it, because often when we impose those sorts of realities, it's more about us than about our child.
Yeah. Yeah. Maria, has that happened? Has there been some discussion at this point?
You know, maybe a year or two ago, you know, she did kind of ask a little more specific about, you know, I think she's trying to understand how he could have died over something that's mental.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had told her, you know, he didn't take his medicines. And I to be honest, I just kind of like brushed it off a little bit, because I was kind of scared as to how I go about,
sure.
You know, he shot himself.
Yeah.
So it's like, I know there are people around that are aware of this, that are adults, and I don't think they would ever bring it up to her, but I don't want her to find out by accident.
Yeah, you probably don't.
So.
I think because there's a risk there that then she feels that you're not forthcoming with her and straight with her. And it's not that probably anybody would throw this at her, but she could be around a conversation or a family reunion or something where some discussion gets made, or someone makes an offhanded joke not knowing she's nearby, and then she kind of hears this and says, you know, what's going on?
Yeah.
So do you identify, or do you think there are opportunities to have this conversation? I mean, and a conversation starter, Betsy, could be something like, do you think about your dad often?
Yes.
You know, something like that.
It'll be very, very important in this situation to follow what kind of identification the child has made with the missing father over time. Many times in families, when there's a lost parent, so many family members will say, oh, you're just like your dad. You remind me of your dad. You look just mm-hmm. like your dad. And mm-hmm. in your case, it sounds like there is some risk for the possibility that your daughter learns from other family members or other friends. That is where I would really try to avoid that event, because I think this is a situation where knowledge from you needs to be shared in a very, very careful way, because you're combining mental illness with death and the kind of action that her father was desperate enough to take. And here, if you don't feel you have the language or the timing quite right, this may be a time to reach out to a professional who can help you with the language and with the many questions that your daughter inevitably will have. Will I do this? Will this happen to me? Will this happen to you, Mommy? Why did this happen to Daddy? What does it mean? Do all people with bipolar disorder take their lives? Oh, my friend's daddy has something like that. And this is where there are so many people in your community that can help you. This is a very serious topic. Your daughter, thankfully, is doing beautifully. But as she enters into the later years of her adolescence, she will put two and two together from every cue that she hears in the environment. And you want to be just a step ahead of her if possible.
It may be that it's worthwhile for you to even rehearse this or practice
this.
If you have a therapist or a close, trusted friend or someone you could talk to or a parent yourself, where you might say, here, kind of laying out, I'm kind of thinking about this is what I might say to my daughter to open this up. But I think, as has been said in this half hour, being inquisitive about her experience, her thoughts, that may be a way to start and to just ask a few things and see where she's at with it right now. She'll probably lead you, if you're paying attention to her cues, about how much she wants to know now. And it's a conversation that doesn't have to happen just one time.
Exactly.
You can have it over a period of days, weeks, months, years, as you've perhaps been having it already to some degree, and you can lay out some of the details over time so that you make sure that she does know that he killed himself by suicide, because quite frankly, that's an important fact for her to know at some point. And it's important for her to know he had bipolar disorder. And in fact, I would argue it's even important for her to know that he used the violent means, like a handgun, because there are for the risk factors that shows us in terms of what might be sort of genetically a load for her. Yet you don't want to throw that down as a gauntlet and say, here's what you got to know, here's what happened, etc.
This discussion echoes something we were talking about before about the shooting, around building resilient kids, is that as a parent prepares to reveal in a thoughtful way these sorts of information about what happened, what you're doing is you're communicating that your child is strong enough to take in the information. If it's all a secret, you're communicating that, you know, as a family, we are not strong enough to manage things like this. It communicates implicitly your trust in your child, and you're communicating your trustworthiness as well. Again, it's so important to do this in a very caring, thoughtful way, attuned with the child. But it's really saying, you know, we can do this as a family together, no matter how hard or difficult the circumstances.
Yeah. Maria, a great question, a terrible difficulty you've had in your family. Our hearts go out to you and your daughter, and yet we know that, as you have already, that you will persevere through this and that you will be supportive of her. Let us know how it goes. If you start to have this conversation in a few months and you have something to share, please give us a call back. We thank you for listening. We hope it was helpful. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to About Our Kids, Doctor Radio, Sirius XM 110. Betsy Shirlevy and Glenn Sachs are our guests. We're talking about trauma in the wake of the Pittsburgh and other recent shootings and massacres. Our number is 877-698-3627 or by email at docs@siriusxm.com. We'll be back in just a couple of moments.
Unprecedented in access to top physicians and the location within the NYU Langone Medical Center. This is Doctor Radio.
Welcome back. This is Jess Schatkin along with Betsy Shirlevy and Glenn Sachs. You're listening to About Our Kids on Doctor Radio, Sirius XM 110. We're speaking this first segment about trauma. We're talking about in the wake of recent shootings, the Pittsburgh massacre being foremost and present in our minds. So many people lost. And we're entertaining your calls and trying to be helpful for talking with you about the traumas you and your kids may have experienced, or how to talk to your kids about trauma, or how to talk to your kids about events in the news. Our number is 877-NYU-DOCS. That's 877-698-3627 or by email at docs@siriusxm.com. And there's still so much to talk about. So again, give us a shout. We'd love to hear from you. We appreciate our callers from the last segment. So, you know, there one of the things that Melanie, our producer, was bringing up in the segment in the break we were just having is this idea of hate and talking to kids about, you know, about how to process these bad feelings. You know, there's probably lots of Jewish kids running around these days saying, why do people hate us? Or there are maybe black kids running around saying, why do people hate us? Why are we why are we seen as so different? And, you know, it can be any ethnic group or any religious group that you like. You know, kids are different and they may have these questions, they may not, but there's undoubtedly some questions about what makes us different or unlikable because of that. And I wonder if either of you have any thoughts about how to either raise that topic or address that when it comes up.
I guess one thing I'd say about that is, and it gets to what we were talking about before, about parents reflecting reality and not stepping back from it.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is hatred. There are bad people that hurt good people, and yeah, there's no way around it. I mean, in human history, we've struggled with how to understand evil and the nature of evil. And so mm-hmm. we can't, with our kids, step away from that. And to do our best to, one, again, understand what's behind the question, why is the kid asking, what do they want to know? So ask, you know, be more curious, listen more than talk. But, you know, say, this is a reality. And also, be clear about what you don't know. It's okay to tell your child, you know, I don't understand either.
Yeah.
Even though I don't understand, this is real, and my job is to do everything in my power mm-hmm. to protect you, and the adults around you are here to help make things safe for us.
Yeah. I think this is a great observation about how you need to share with your kids. Sometimes you don't know. You don't have all the answers, and you don't know why people hate necessarily. But undoubtedly, kids sometimes parrot what they hear on TV. They parrot what their parents have said at home. They may come in and, you know, they may have heard something about black people, and then they start saying this at school because that's what they've heard, because somewhere in their life somebody said something to them, but yet they don't really know, and then they start to fix these beliefs. So how do you teach your kids to say something, to talk back? You know, thinking about being in New York City where there's such a mix of people, there's probably nowhere else in the world where you've got so many different types of people all living together on a subway train or on a street. What do you teach your kids to do when they hear these comments or these things are said to them?
Right. My answer reflects so much of what you've both just brought up. How do we answer that question? One way we can approach it is that people who don't understand differences and therefore develop hate for those who are different really haven't been educated in what makes all of us the same and what it means to be different and what it means to be human. And I think here we get into a discussion of education, learning about different people, learning about different societies. Where are their common grounds? Where are their hearts and feelings and minds? Why are parents and grandparents maybe saying things actually at home or even in school that we don't understand and we just mimic because we don't understand? Here, I really depend on education. I think that with less ignorance and with more knowledge, people begin to understand why they're threatened by differences and where we all share a common ground. And perhaps some of this can begin to decrease mm-hmm. some of these tragic hatings.
Yeah. It's interesting. You know, my daughter attends college in the Midwest, and I think it's predominantly a white kids at that school. But she grew up in New York City, went to public schools, had a very, very diverse education.
Right.
And there's political correctness in the school that she's in where kids
are
always saying things like, you know, you can't talk about this. You can't talk about the differences, that you can't even sort of notice the differences in some ways. And my daughter says, you know, I grew up in New York City. We talk about the differences all the time because they're there and they're real. And so it's a really interesting juxtaposition of, do you share the differences? Is it okay to notice that this culture does this or that this group of people does that, and they're your friends and you live side by side with them, and there are some differences, and those differences are okay to notice, or do you act like they're not there, in which case you're kind of, it's sort of the same kind of perpetuation of, you know, not
the
integrating.
Myth.
Not the myth,
right.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a more positive angle, but it's still not real.
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. All right, callers, we encourage you to chime in. 877-698-3627 is our number. We'd love to hear from you if you have questions or comments that you want to share about how to talk to your kids about trauma, what to think about this. So if your child, after an event like this, is afraid to go to school, Glenn, or says, I don't want to go to school, or I don't want to go to church, or, you know, I whatever, how do you talk to them about that?
Yeah. One, you want to know why they don't want to go, what they're worried will happen, and take it at that level. You want to know, you want to be as curious as possible. And with that, you want to help them with that. But you want to model that, well, first say it's very important to go to school. And as I said before, around assuring that the adults know about this and will do everything in their power to help make things safe. But again, I don't think there's any right answer except to know what's behind the question and address it at that level. I'll also say another thing is that the music is way more important than the words. In other words, kind of your tone as you talk to the child, being confident in what's going to happen, your strength in helping your child, as opposed to the specific words you might say. So the child just knows you're with them in their corner and there for them no matter what.
Well, what you're really saying is that Elton John is much more important than Bernie Taupin.
Okay,
that's,
yeah,
that's really
well,
what you're saying.
That is obviously true.
That's always the case.
Okay, all right, yeah. Music is more important than the words.
The only thing that I would add to that is to help children feel that the rabbi, the priest, the teacher, the mm-hmm. administration are doing things to protect them, and they will be taught strategies to help them remain as safe as possible. We cannot promise them that this will never happen, but we can promise them that we will be prepared as possible to ensure their safety should these horrible things happen. And they may want to be active about these fears and participate in the community, in the schools, in the temples, coming up with ideas that will help to keep them safe, because they're watching everything that's happening around them. And active participation can often decrease fear.
Yeah. Is there an ideal time to have these conversations? Time of day?
Well, certainly not.
Place?
Certainly not before bed.
Not before bed.
Certainly in the bright light of daytime. Certainly when the family is together, if it's appropriate for the developmental age of the children for the family to be together. Maybe during a meal, for example, or taking a walk to the park. But never in the evening, never when someone's having a bad day for other reasons. Mm-hmm. Neutral times.
And what about teens who are aware of what's going on? They're seeing what's going on in the news. They see what's on TV. And you say, hey, I'd like to talk to you about this. And like, it's no big deal. You know, they sort of blow it off. They act like they don't want to talk to you. Do you persist?
I might persist a little bit by reflecting, your own, that this is a big event. Is there anything you're concerned about?
Or maybe I'd like to talk about it with you.
Right.
Myself.
Of course.
If that's real, that's what you do. But but you also just, you want them to know that if you want to talk about it, mm-hmm. I am here to help in any way you want.
Yeah. And I would imagine there are people in communities all over the U.S. now thinking specifically about Pittsburgh Pittsburgh's a unique place in many ways. It's actually a fantastic city for those who haven't visited. It's really worth it. You wouldn't imagine, but it really is. Knowing the steel history and being some landlocked kind of town, it's a really beautiful, beautiful city with great people who stay many generations. And I read a statistic that something like 26%, I think that was a number, of the Jewish people living in the Pittsburgh, in Allegheny County, live in Squirrel Hill. So it's a very densely populated Jewish neighborhood in a inner city environment, or sort of urban at least, where you don't have a lot of those communities anymore. We've got a density of people of one culture in an urban environment in the way they used to be maybe 100 years ago. But there are probably lots of communities that don't know many Jews. There's about 11 or 12 million Jews out of the 7 billion people in the world. They're not a very big group. And if you are in Kansas, or if you are in, you know, Champaign-Urbana, or if you are, God, I don't know, wherever you might be, and you don't know Jews, and the kids are saying, so why would people be killing these people? Is there something specific to say to that as well? I mean, why are people after these people? I'm not asking for a theological discussion, but it could be Jews, or it could be blacks, it could be Asians, it could be any group that is different. But how do you have that conversation with people who may not be familiar with the culture?
I mean, the general idea is hatred of people who are different.
Exactly.
And that, you know, wherever you are, to communicate to children that, you know, we need to understand people who are different, and you know, it may make us feel uncomfortable knowing about differences, but that's not what we are about. You know, yeah. I would focus on the issue of differences and why we need to appreciate differences and that sort of thing.
Okay.
Right. And this speaks again to the issue of education throughout our country. Because if you are in Topeka, Kansas, you probably have not interacted with many Jewish people or mm-hmm. many black people, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And that is where knowledge is so critical for yeah. these children.
And you've talked about this a few times now, Betsy. Let's get into it. So how can we, or what should we, if you have an idea, change our educational approach to kids to enhance this? I mean, there's nothing like experience.
Right.
And
no,
as
of
I was pointing
not.
Out with my daughter's experience growing up in New York City public schools, where she took the subway 2 hours a day. I mean, what an experience in diversity. But a lot of people don't have that advantage.
No,
and that also can breed, by the way, as much racism as anything else.
Absolutely.
you can develop stereotypes around people.
Excellent point, Jess. Yeah. That is a very important point.
Yeah.
But I think to study cultures mm-hmm. and to study different societies and to study American history and European history is a fabulous way of educating a child about all of the different groups that have made up our world. And you might begin to identify with philosophies that these other groups lived by. You may agree, you may disagree, but it's a fabulous classroom discussion. Mm-hmm. And that opens the minds of children and opens their ability to ask questions mm-hmm. as opposed to just, you know, they're different than I am. I won't come in contact with them. My parents don't really like them, and it's not relevant. Well, if you open up the discourse in the classroom with an educated professor who can speak to this, mm-hmm. it's a world of difference.
And also to model something. I mean, people may hear, you know, racist, anti-Semitic comments, but a parent that, you know, stands up and corrects that if they hear it in front of their child. You're modeling courage. You're modeling taking risk in the right way. You're communicating strength and what you expect. And again, it's really important. Otherwise, it's just words.
Mm-hmm. So I remember the first, to my recollection, the first sort of racist thing that I heard in my life. It was. You know, 10 at night, and I was probably 10 or 11. We were driving through the Central Valleys of California. I grew up in San Francisco. We were driving to the Sierras to go camping or something. And we stopped at a gas station in the Central Valleys, which are a little more homogeneous there, a little more by history, at least historically. And I heard someone say the N-word at a gas station. Mm-hmm. And it was a man. I'm 10-year-old, 11-year-old. The man is in his 20s. And I wouldn't have had the gumption to say something back at that point or to do anything. I don't remember where my parents were. Maybe they were pumping the gas, or maybe they were there. I just don't remember, but I overheard it. And I remember feeling a lot of fear and not knowing what to do with that. you know, do you have any, just given what you were saying, Glenn, I mean, that may not have been a safe environment for someone to say something. I don't know. But I don't think I ever had that conversation with my parents. Yeah.
So, I mean, you all, as a parent, you always want to appraise, you know, the risk. I mean, you're not going to do something when you really think there may be big time violence.
Sure, someone's going to pull a knife on you.
And all of that.
Exactly.
But then you never leave it unstated. You bring it up with your child. You talk about your perspective on it. Again, I think if you can, it's really important to model courage in the moment. If not, then it's important to bring it up directly with the child and make your opinion about it very clear to them.
Yeah. All right. Where else do we go on this topic? Are there other things that we feel need to be addressed or discussed? And I want to encourage parents, again, if you have any questions about trauma, any concerns about your kids, give us a call, 877-698-3627. Questions in the wake of school shooting, synagogue shooting, violence. How do you talk to your kids? Well, one thing we didn't talk about was the media and the media they watch.
Exactly.
And they see. And this happens a lot, right, where things get played and played and played again. Either you become immune to it or it's traumatizing for people. Maybe we can say a few things about that.
Well, in the younger years, for sure, with the little kids, we very much, suggest that there is no exposure to the media, that the television is turned off, the newspapers are put aside, upside down, that as little is shown as possible, because the likelihood is that from the ages of 2 to 5, the information will be A, misconstrued, B, misunderstood, and C, the source of tremendous fear and anxiety. So for the real little ones, we would say keep the media away. And for the older children who are beginning to talk about the media perspectives, as we're seeing so much now in our society, different media, the different ways that media present a situation, there I think you want to be with your child, asking your child what they've learned from the media, helping them to distill what they have learned and learn as a family how it is presented. And when it's too much, it's too much. Even for a teenager, it can be too much. You'll notice that after hearing a lot of media, a kid will go in their room and put their earphones on, and they're not listening to Elton John these days. We wish they were, but they're listening to something. They will shut down after too much exposure. And here is where it also morphs into the discussion of what your child hears from the media. For example, will a child with pre-existing anxiety disorders or who suffered trauma or who has developmental delays hear the same thing from the media? And Glenn, here's your point about ask them what they have heard. How do they understand it? And that's what's so important about the media right now, because it's excessive, but it's critical.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've talked a lot about in the past and as practitioners about kids watching the same thing again and again.
Exactly.
And again and again. And we didn't talk about post-traumatic stress disorder, but certainly for kids who've experienced trauma before, any kind of trauma can be a reminder. Yeah, Glenn?
Yeah. Basically, at its core, post-traumatic stress disorder is someone's world becomes completely unsafe. And it's the process of them recovering from that, where they repeatedly, in context even that are safe, they feel they're under immediate danger. So there's nothing like an event like this to bring everything back.
Yeah.
And so if you have a child with post-traumatic stress disorder, you need to be extra attuned to really anticipate that this can be a problem, to check in. To make sure your child gets the help they need.
Yeah. All right, guys, our hour is coming to a close, so I want to thank you so much for joining us. Betsy Shirlevy, psychologist in private practice and adjunct faculty at Teachers College Columbia, and you're a consulting psychologist for the 92nd Street Y Nursery School for many years. Your website is drbetsylevy.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And Glenn Sachs, you're a professor in the Department of Child Adolescent Psychiatry I love this title. In the Child Study Center at the Hassenfeld Children's Hospital, NYU Langone School of Medicine. And you're co-author of the book Trauma Systems Therapy for Kids, and your website is www.traumasystemstherapy.com. Yeah. All right. I want to let people know that I'm going to be in Denver next week speaking on November 5th at the Crest Hill Middle School. Come on out. We'll talk about adolescent risk-taking decision-making, and November 6th at the Crossroads Community Church in Ponderosa High School in Douglas County, just outside of Denver. And when we come back this next segment, it's all Q&A. It's emails and phone calls, so please queue up your calls. I'd love to hear from you. It's open phone lines for the next hour with me. We have some emails. We'll get to your phone calls, 877-698-3627, by email docs@siriusxm.com. We'll see you in just a moment.